again, we're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
I'm glad that we have, like, Slut Walk and people out in Toronto started this kind of movement and has caught on. So I'm really grateful for that. I think that's good progress.
Coming up, we'll hear from Chicagoans who participated in a new movement supporting sexual assault victims.
I want to share with you a sampling of the work on struggling for a better medium in the United States with the hopes of inspiring you to join the work and empowering you with this story, especially given the central role that media play in all struggles for a better tomorrow and the successes that we have won, with hopefully more successes to come.
And we'll learn more about the history of U.S. corporate media and media reform efforts from a Chicago media activist. But first, here are some recent headlines from the Indie Media Network in Chicago and around the world with Mitchell Strepinchik.
Ireland Indie Media reported on efforts by Irish police to belittle activists who recorded a rape threat made by police. On March 31, 2011, two female activists arrested protesting a Shell oil refinery inadvertently recorded a police conversation which included a rape threat made against one of the women in custody. Authorities set up two inquiries into the matter, but according to some of the campaigners involved in releasing the infamous recordings, Gardaí, that is Irish police, and the Garda Ombudsman fed false and damaging information to crime reporters in an attempt to minimize and divert attention from the content of the recordings and to undermine the credibility of the two women whose arrest led to the scandal. Reporters who were known to receive these rumors did not deny that the rumors had emanated from Gardaí, but agreed at least not to publish the false rumors. Poland Indie Media featured reports of protests in Warsaw amid the visit of U.S. President Barack Obama to Poland. On May 27th and 28th, 2011, activists organized a Day of Rage, highlighting a panoply of domestic problems in Poland, including the destruction of workers' rights and tenants' rights, rising prices, the commercialization of education and health services, as well as the ignorance of the public to the state of affairs. One protest picket outside of a building which housed President Obama used signs with the Polish pun Baraki dla Obamy, translated as Huts for Obama, calling attention to the lack of community housing in Poland. Rochester Indie Media and DC Indie Media featured a press release of a financial victory for three Minnesota activists. Quoting from the release, "Three activists and their attorneys won a $50,000 settlement today, May 26, 2011, in a lawsuit that challenged an August 30, 2008 police raid on a St. Paul home in advance of that year's Republican National Convention. The plaintiffs in the case, Sarah Coffey, Aaron Stalnacker, and Chris Hermes, are giving most of the award to the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, the Institute for Anarchist Studies, and the formation of a National Legal Defense Fund for political activists. The St. Paul House raid was one of several police actions taken against protesters days before the Republican National Convention began, including the search and seizure of a central political meeting space, which is also the subject of pending litigation." Indie Bay featured a dramatic musical protest outside the California state capitol in defense of old-growth California forests. For most of 2011, the group Richardson Grove Action Now, or RGAN, has been organizing rallies and protests against the plan to extend California Highway 101 through Richardson Grove State Park and adjacent forests in Northern California. On June 9, 2011, RGAN staged a dramatic musical protest flash mob outside the California State Capitol in Sacramento, singing a version of the George Clinton song We Got the Funk, but with updated lyrics about the opposition to the highway extension, while informing passersby with literature and flyers. The highway expansion plan would have significant global environmental effects, as it threatens some of the last 2% of remaining ancient redwoods on Earth. Boston Indie Media featured a report about a contentious public meeting and arrests over a proposed expansion of a national franchise. On June 3, 2011, representatives of Whole Foods held a public meeting in the Boston neighborhood of Jamaica Plain, trying to convince residents of the benefits of having a Whole Foods franchise in their neighborhood. The move is opposed by a neighborhood-based group called Who's Foods, which noted the so-called Whole Foods effect of gentrification emerging around new Whole Foods outlets. Whose Foods mobilized 100 people to wear t-shirts critical of Whole Foods, and three activists unfurled a banner reading, "Displacement, what is Whole Foods going to do about it?" to raucous applause. Three people connected with the banner were arrested, and later charged with one count each of disrupting a public assembly. The Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center featured developments of the eroding credibility of another national franchise, quoting from the feature, 2 months after Jimmy John's fired six workers for blowing the whistle on a company practice of forcing sandwich makers to work while sick, the Industrial Workers of the World Jimmy John's Workers Union has released Minnesota Department of Health documents today, June 5, 2011, revealing 8 outbreaks of foodborne illness at franchises across the Twin Cities area in the past 5 years, 7 of which were due to employees working while sick at the chain. The release of the document seriously erodes the credibility of Minneapolis franchise owner Mike Mulligan, who had previously claimed to reporters and employees that, quote, "The company has made more than 6 million sandwiches during its nearly 10 years in business, and no one's ever gotten sick from eating one," unquote. Two of the outbreaks, both caused by sick employees, were at the Mulligan's stores. Chicago Indie Media featured breaking developments of a renewed protest in defense of a threatened Chicago school fieldhouse. On Wednesday, June 23, 2011, a wrecking crew arrived outside La Casita, the fieldhouse of Whittier Elementary School in Chicago's Pilsen neighborhood. The Chicago Public Schools, with a new head and under a new administration, turned its back on a deal to preserve the fieldhouse, which Whittier parents, students, and supporters won in the late summer and early fall of 2010, thanks to a 44-day-long sit-in protest. After the original deal was called off, Whittier supporters launched a new round-the-clock sit-in, asking the community for support and calling on the Chicago Public Schools and Chicago Alderman Dan Solis to restore the previous deal.
Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
I am not a pretty girl. That's not what I do. I ain't no damsel in distress. And I don't need to be rescued, so put me down. A maiden fair. Isn't there a kitten stuck up a tree somewhere? And I am not an angry girl, but it seems like I've got everyone fooled. Every time I say something they find hard to hear, they chalk it up to my anger, never to their own fear. And imagine you're a girl just trying to finally complain. No way full well they prefer you were dirty and smiling. And I am sorry, but I am not a maiden fair. And I am not a kitten stuck up a tree somewhere.
On January 24, 2011, a male representative of the Toronto Police made a remark that sparked a worldwide political protest movement that women should avoid dressing like sluts in order not to be victimized. That remark inspired two Toronto female activists to organize the first Slut Walk, a public protest against the notion that a woman's appearance somehow justifies or minimizes rape, sexual assault, or a mentality of blaming the victim. Although the word slut carries negative connotations, the Slut Walk movement seeks to recast the word in a more positive light, as other political movements have done for other stigmatized words. The first Slut Walk was held in Toronto in April 2011, and more than 20 Slut Walks have been held worldwide since, including in Chicago, which held the inaugural Chicago Slut Walk on June 4, 2011. We'll hear now two brief interviews of participants of Chicago Slut Walk by Aaron Sinek of Chicagoist.com.
So if you're comfortable with giving me your name, totally cool. If not,
My name is Holland, H-O-L-L-Y-N, Michael. Anyway, I am doing this because I believe there's a lot of misinformation about rape. A lot of people think, like, oh, she's asking for it, she was dressing slutty, so that makes it more okay, and people don't seem to focus very much on the fact that for rape to occur, there has to be a rapist. It wasn't, like, this girl's fault. Like, she was drunk, she was in dark alley, she was wearing a short skirt, she was promiscuous. She was still raped if she said no and didn't consent. I believe a prostitute can get raped if she's, like, saying, no, I'm not doing this. Like, that can happen, and I feel like a lot of people just don't believe that or don't want to believe that. They want to find fault with the victim, and I think that's, like, completely unhelpful. I work with abused women. I'm a counselor. And so I see that all the time. People feel so blamed and so ashamed. It takes them years to come forward, and they just carry around all this guilt and shame that they feel like they did something wrong, that they caused this, and people don't seem to remember or think about, like, the person who actually, you know, abused them, whether it's physically or sexually or emotionally. There must be something wrong with her. She stayed, or she allowed it to happen, or she did something wrong.
Kind of tend to find it very strange that, if you don't mind me asking your age.
Yeah, I'm 25.
25, okay. I kind of find it very, very strange that I live in the future, in 2007.
Yeah.
And this is necessary.
Yeah, I know.
Because it should be obvious.
Yeah, it should be very obvious at this point.
Do you think that, I mean, comparatively, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that we've made some kind of progression with that kind of forward social thinking? Or do you think are you surprised that we're still stuck?
I am still kind of surprised that we're still stuck, but I think we have made maybe a little progress since the 70s and 80s. There are some, like, this is it, this is happening, and there's still people who are wanting to get the word out, and I think that there has been a little bit of progress. Like, some shows like Law and Order, SVU doesn't always get it right, but they do try and make a point about something like not blaming the victim and things like that.
Right.
So I think we've made a little bit of progress. We still have a long way to go. Like, the fact that we have to do this, that news media still gets it wrong, and those poor guys who raped that girl, like, they're being blamed by this girl, this slut who's out to get them. And they are these great varsity athletes, or, you know, anything like that. They couldn't possibly have done this. This girl's out to get them somehow. And, you know, maybe that's true. It's probably not true. But, you know, it's probably not true. So, I do find it surprising and unfortunate. But I'm glad that we have, like, Slut Walk, and people out in Toronto started this kind of movement, and has caught on. So I'm really grateful for that. I think that's good progress.
How did you find out?
You know, I think I found out from feministing.com.
Okay.
They wrote about the Toronto, and then I Googled Slut Walk and looked to find one that was maybe started in the Chicago area.
Okay.
So yeah, I originally heard about it on feministing.com.
Why are you guys here?
Why are you here? You get to start first.
No.
Okay. We're here because it's ridiculous to think that anybody is ever at fault for being a victim of a crime. It's the person who decided to do the crime in the first place. It's their fault. And I like the idea that so many people, at least where I live, have that same idea and are willing to do something to change other people's perceptions about it. That's a really wonderful feeling for me. But also, as I can tell from sort of talking to people about why I'm going that weren't already going, there's kind of a long way to go. So,
do you think it's kind of like when you run into those people, you're like, okay, I'm going to the Slut Walk. I'm doing this because we live in the 21st century. And when you actually find, like, an raised eyebrow to that, is that weird?
It's not weird because I expect it, but that's the weird part when I think about it, is that I expect people to wonder why I'm, you know, walking for a cause like this, that I expect to have to, like, come back and, like, challenge it things like that, you know, to defend myself for being like, nope, I'm walking because I think the survivors shouldn't be questioned.
Well, why? I mean, is that, to me, like, my, I mean, I'm, of course, even though I'm not even fake being objective.
Right, that's right.
You know, like,
I understand.
I don't actually get why people have to, one, this shouldn't be necessary at all.
Right, but my original sign was going to say, it's my birthday and I shouldn't have to be here.
I love that.
Yeah. It's my birthday, happy 100th culture.
Either way, though, but I mean, it shouldn't be necessary, and the fact that you do have to defend it is bizarre. But comparatively, I'm not sure how old you guys are, but, like, comparatively to 10, 20, 30 years ago, one would like to think that there's been some social progress, but has there been?
I think there has been with the people that want the change, but people who are happy with how it is. There's just this, like, sort of shield up, like, but things are okay right now, so it's fine.
But, okay, why exactly are there even people like
that? Oh, well, I was talking to somebody else about this. One of the reasons, I think, for the sort of societal idea that it's the survivor's fault that they got raped is that it makes the other people feel safe. Like, well, I would never dress like that, and I would never get drunk like that, so it's not going to happen to me, and it makes them feel safer. To be able to say there's something different about that person. I'm not a slut, so I'm not going to get raped. Only sluts get raped, and I don't identify with the name of the slut. So therefore, I'm immune to rape. But so I think that's one of the reasons it stays. I would say that's probably the number one reason it stays, is that somehow that got started, and even if people don't know that it makes them feel safe, it does.
And then last question, how did you guys find out about the event?
I don't remember.
You invited me.
I know. I don't know. I think Facebook. But I'm not really sure.
it's hard to be like, you know, it's a thing that
it just happened.
Yeah. All right, cool.
Yeah.
You've been listening to interviews from the inaugural Chicago Slutwalk protest against sexual assault and a blaming the victim mentality towards sexual assault. We're coming to you from the trenches. Many political activists complain about the media. The media don't cover important issues, or cover them badly when they bother covering them, and the media wastes too much time on unimportant topics. But while many activists complain about the media, far fewer political activists actually take on the media as an issue in its own right. In the past decade, more activists, realizing the importance of media given its centrality to a great many other issues, have taken up media as a cause in its own right, and as a result have earned more wins on media issues. But despite these recent successes, one might think that activism on media issues is a relatively recent phenomenon. On the contrary, it goes all the way back to the beginning of the United States. We'll learn more about the history of media and media activism in the United States in this presentation by Chicago Indie Media contributor and longtime media activist Mitchell Stupinchik. The following presentation, entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles, was recorded at Chicago's Third Unitarian Church on January 16, 2011.
The title of this presentation, as Laurel had mentioned, is indeed Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles. So, I will provide a capsule history of media in the United States, focusing on the corporate control of media domestically and the struggles to counter that corporate control running through to the present day, even alluding to events that occurred last month. This presentation is divided roughly by medium: print and newspapers first, then the telegraph, the telephone, movies, radio, television, what I call cross-media concentration, and the internet, with some summarizing remarks at the end. I will keep a roughly chronological flow in this presentation, though I reserve the right to time travel, jumping on occasion from the past to the future and back again. I want to share with you a sampling of the work on struggling for a better medium in the United States, with the hopes of inspiring you to join the work and empowering you with this story, especially given the central role that media play in all struggles for a better tomorrow and the successes that we have won, with hopefully more successes to come. We begin our story with the founding of the first national media network in the United States, though many people today don't consider it a media resource. Yet it was incredibly critical for forging an open and diverse discourse in the early United States for the better part of 70 years. I'm referring to the post office. Most of the post office's traffic before 1840 was newspapers. Indeed, the percentage of postal traffic that comprised newspapers that the Postal Service sent grew from 70%, 70, in 1794 to 90% in 1832. Indeed, in the early days of the American Republic, it was a given that a democratic society required as wide a realm of discourse as possible, and that the post office should be subsidized by the government to help to encourage that discourse. Some even thought that all postal traffic should always be free, but nevertheless, a modest tax was implemented. Indeed, many social justice movements of the early 19th century, including the growing abolitionist movement, credited these post office subsidies for the growth of their own media and, as a result, their own social justice efforts. There's a connection with the 19th century newspaper industry, jumping up a little bit ahead, and the telegraph, which we'll see in a moment. The modern electric telegraph was patented in 1844 by Samuel Morse. Morse, with the help of advances in the science of electricity and other technical advances, was able to perfect the single-wire telegraph, allowing for far faster communications than ever before. But the fate of its widespread use, unlike that of the post office, which was nationalized, was not slated for nationalization by an indifferent Congress in 1844, as well as facing the growing power of capital in 19th century America. Instead, the telegraph was subject to market whims, at first with more than 50 different telegraphy firms, which ultimately consolidated into just one company, Western Union. Critics had feared that a monopoly of the telegraph could lead to unfair advantages in stock transactions. But another problem regarding corporate control of the news via telegraph would also emerge, starting from a coalition of five New York newspapers who pooled their funds in 1846 to share the cost of telegraph time for the transfer of urgent news. This group called itself the New York Associated Press, which grew over time to encompass more than just New York, in fact the entire country, dropping the New York part of its name, becoming the Associated Press, and working out an exclusive arrangement with Western Union to become the only newswire service in the United States. From 1880 to 1910, calls for nationalization of the telegraph began to grow as part of the general populist movement of efforts in the United States at the time. There were calls to raise what was called the infernal bondage between the AP and Western Union. In response, some 70 congressional bills were introduced between 1866 and 1900 calling for telegram reform, including even nationalization of the telegram. Western Union lobbyists wound up defeating all 70 of those bills. And the newspapers, especially those aligned with the Associated Press, refused to accede to the question of nationalizing the telegraph, understandably so given the dependence on the telegraph for news. Around the same time, a new medium, not one primarily restricted to big newspapers, stock traders, and other effete groups, would extend to a greater portion of the population than the telegraph ever did. That medium, ironically enough, stemmed directly from attempts to advance the technology of the telegraph, one of whose pioneers was a professor of phonetics at Boston University named Alexander Graham Bell. Bell, and particularly Bell's father-in-law, Gardner Green Hubbard, who had far more of a nose for business than Bell ever did, wound up winning the patent wars for an advance of what was referred to as the harmonic telegraph. It's the idea of transmitting multiple different telegraph signals, or harmonics, across a single wire. But those harmonics can also carry individual sound frequencies, like those of the human voice. And it ultimately became known as the telephone. By 1877, the Bell Telephone Company, and its successor in the wake of a number of intervening mergers, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, or AT&T, would itself become a behemoth thanks to monopoly control of that patent. But after the telephone patent wound up expiring in 1894, many, many aspiring telephone groups and cooperatives entered the fray. The independents, as they were called, would go on to expand telephone service across the country, particularly in rural environments, which were often ignored as not being enough of a lucrative market for AT&T. The independents at their peak held some 40% of the overall telephone market and were starting to do something that AT&T did not do, innovate. By 1908, AT&T was in trouble, and that's when AT&T President Theodore Vail began to act. He deployed a PR offensive with a slogan touting universal service. He bought out some of those independent telephone companies, and he sublicensed with others for technical preference. That and a growing unease with dual service. It's important to note that the phone lines by AT&T and by the independents were incompatible, so that required every household to practically have two separate phone lines. All of that helped to turn the tide, so much so that by 1920, AT&T controlled 66% of the market, and by 1932, 81% of the market. And it wouldn't look back until even the 1980s, when an antitrust settlement finally broke the AT&T monopoly. During the early 20th century, both the growing telephone industry and the shrinking telegraph industry were facing another rival that neither industry could do: show moving pictures. The movie environment, in the days of the silent film era from 1900 to about 1920, was markedly wide open, where neighborhood theaters sprouted up and the cost of producing short films was rather low. Thus, many people entered the game of producing and showing films, including a great many political activists making films related to one or another cause, including labor activism, women's suffrage, and political radicalism. The first factor in the change of this environment was what was called the Edison Trust, an effort to monopolize control of American film stock owned by Thomas Edison. But the Edison Trust was stymied by independent film efforts, the growth of new longer feature films, and the continuing growth of theaters to show those films. The victory over the Edison Trust wound up becoming utterly total. Not only was the trust put on the defensive and ultimately terminated by a court in 1918, by 1925, all of the companies comprising the trust went out of business. Yet those independents would, from 1920 to 1930, become the new status quo, with an influence far greater than the Edison Trust ever held. I'm referring to the studio system of movies. What became the studio system began by an orphaned Hungarian emigre and furrier named Adolf Zukor. Zukor and his business partners opened a chain of film arcades along the east coast of the United States. Then they organized a film production company called the Famous Players Film Company, then signed a distribution contract with Paramount, and through various maneuvers secured control of all avenues of making movies, production, distribution, and theaters, far more than the Edison Trust ever held. That formation of Paramount spurred a trend of consolidation within the film industry in the 1920s. And many of the main players in what would become the studio system came from hardscrabble backgrounds like Zukor. Harry Warner, a founder of Warner Brothers, was an emigre clothier from Poland who got into films when a Nickelodeon opened near his store and did better business than his clothing store. William Fox was another Hungarian emigre who got into textiles, and he sold his whole textile company just to start his first Nickelodeon. They and a handful of others stood atop the eight film companies from the ensuing consolidation. The Big Five, as they were known: Fox, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Radio Keith Orpheum, or RKO, and Lowe's, the parent of MGM, as well as three other majors, as they were called: Universal, Columbia, and United Artists. As part of their effort against the Edison Trust, these independents, although they would become the studio system, used the production of longer feature films, which by virtue of their length cost more and required more film. That, among other factors, resulted in forming barriers to entry in the film market. Films that could be produced for perhaps $1,000 in 1920 would, by 1930, cost upwards of $40,000. Not to mention the new requirements for this newfangled technology, sound. The Jazz Singer, the very first sound feature film feature to feature sound in 1927, cost $500,000 to produce. That, and the creation of elegant movie palaces by the studio system across America, raised the ante for costs further. Labor unions and radicals simply couldn't afford to compete with higher costs. Many radical and oppositional filmmakers struggled to survive, and a lot simply dropped out. Mind you, in 1928, this could have changed dramatically despite these attacks. A proposal by a single movie electrician, Patrick Murphy, could have turned America's labor temples, then about 1,500 in number, into the largest movie distribution chain in America. But labor leaders at the time, unfortunately, were dismissive. They regarded this proposal as secondary to the work of real organizing efforts, not sympathetic with the potential of movies to inspire and encourage activism. And with labor rank and file not willing or able to force the matter on the table, the studio system was ultimately triumphant. It was around the same time when yet another new medium caught the attention of a nation and a movement for media reform struggles. The struggle over radio in the 1920s and 30s may have been the high watermark in media reform struggles in American history. Radio in the 1920s was dominated by hundreds of nonprofits and universities, but a court ruling in 1926 invalidated all radio licenses since there was no congressional authority to grant radio licenses. That led to a free-for-all of the radio spectrum, and Congress, in response, hurriedly passed the Radio Act of 1927, which authorized a new government commission, the Federal Radio Commission, or FRC, to authorize new radio licenses. The FRC was dominated by commercial interests related to radio manufacturing, and its general counsel was Chicago Tribune Corporation Lewis Caldwell. He was an attorney with the Tribune. And there was a wide distaste for advertising on radio despite this commercial involvement. Skepticism even arose that advertising could provide enough of a viable funding base. Nevertheless, the FRC joined up with the Trade Association of Commercial Broadcasting, the National Association of Broadcasters. It was actually founded in Chicago at the Drake Hotel in 1922, and I like to refer to them as the National Association of Bastards. The NAB, as they were called, along with two incipient radio networks, the National Broadcasting Company, which was the result of RCA buying out AT&T's broadcasting properties, and the Columbia Broadcasting System, which was bought and nurtured by another Chicago guy, a Chicago-born cigar manufacturer's son named William Paley. CBS, NBC, and the NAB wound up crafting, with almost no outside involvement, a 1928 reallocation of radio licenses to give the choicest frequencies and strongest broadcast strengths to commercial broadcasters. As a result of this, for the next 7 years, a coalition of civic groups fought back and included educators like a coalition founded in Chicago in 1930, the National Coalition for Education on Radio, as well as organized labor exemplified by WCFL, a Chicago radio station owned and run by the Chicago Federation of Labor, hence the call letters WCFL, along with religious groups exemplified perhaps best by the Missionary Society of St. Paul the Apostle of New York, better known as the Paulist Fathers, who ran their own radio station. They were all inspired by the positive potential of radio and examples of national nonprofit radio broadcasters like the BBC in Britain and the CBC in Canada. The U.S. commercial broadcasters responded to this challenge with fierceness. They undercut the opposition, set up front groups, granted broadcast time to politicians, saw their audience widen while the opposition's audience shrank, won the critical support of the newspaper industry, and defeated lobbying efforts by community groups in the early 1930s on Capitol Hill for broadcast reform. Reform efforts nevertheless continued, including a 1934 amendment which would have allotted 25% of all radio frequencies in the country to be placed under nonprofit use, and which came very close to becoming law. But that commercial lobbying blitz was able to defuse those efforts, including the use of a rigged 1934 hearing and the 1934 Communications Act, which replaced the FRC with a new Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, and placed as sacrosanct the commercial bias of broadcasting. The coalition of civic groups unraveled, some disbanded, and the dream of national nonprofit radio was dead. But the complaints continued, and the FCC was shamed for some reform actions. Antitrust sentiment in the 1940s resulted in an FCC report on chain broadcasting, which led to NBC spinning off one of its radio networks to become the American Broadcasting Company. You know it as ABC. And a portion of the new FM radio band was allotted to non-commercial broadcasters. That's how the Pacifica Radio Network began in the 1940s by Quaker pacifist Lou Hill, and would serve as a beacon for improving radio and ultimately broadcasting. But as focus turned from radio to television, and I'll be talking a lot about TV in a bit, the relative influence of radio wound up to shrink, and radio stations started gaining more local autonomy but still remained for the most part commercially based. The 1980s, jumping a little bit ahead, saw the emergence of what's called low-power FM radio, LPFM, which helped to restore the community nonprofit potential of radio. This was in no small part thanks to the reduced cost of radio broadcasting equipment and to the efforts of activists like Free Radio Berkeley founder Stephen Dunifer, and to a blind activist, Imbana Kantako, who used a 1-watt radio transmitter to broadcast to his public housing project in Springfield, Illinois. The FCC cracked down on unlicensed LPFM broadcasters, but it was too easy to start new LPFM stations, and so the FCC found it increasingly hard to crack down everyone. So the FCC ultimately proposed, and wound up passing into law, a licensed LPFM service, which passed Congress in 2000, but thanks to a sneaky lobbyist maneuver enacted overnight, the number of potential radio stations was reduced from thousands to hundreds. Nevertheless, LPFM supporters were undaunted, despite two subsequent failed attempts to restore those stolen LPFM stations over a decade of struggle. And finally, just last month, on December 18, 2010, Congress finally approved the long-overdue expansion of LPFM. But jumping back now to the 1950s, radio, at that time in the 1950s, was considered the sideshow to the main media phenomenon, television, a medium long hyped with positive potential. My favorite quote is that of David Sarnoff, the founder of NBC, who in 1939 said, quote, "It is probable that the television drama of high caliber and produced by first-rate artists will materially raise the level of dramatic taste of the nation," unquote. He was a little bit off. There was some struggle over the direction of TV, but it was basically from industry. Which industry would call the shots? Would it be the radio industry, who had the leg up on one-to-many broadcasting? Would it be the movie industry, which was versed in the visual oeuvre? The public was barely involved in the decision, and the result was shamefully corrupt. In 1946, FCC Chair Charles Denny, a Democrat, pushed for and wound up approving a plan giving near monopoly control of television to NBC and CBS. 6 months later, Denny left the FCC to become an executive and general counsel at NBC, tripling his salary. But efforts to chip away at that monopoly control of TV continued in the coming years, including, ironically enough, from the FCC itself. In the 1940s, the FCC proposed a strict proposal of public interest broadcast obligations, referred to as the Blue Book. That helped to lead to policies like the Fairness Doctrine, which sought to break the tedium of perspectives on the airwaves. Newton Minow, FCC chair under President Kennedy and Northwestern University alum and later faculty, gave a 1961 speech entitled Television and the Public Interest to the National Association of Broadcasters. In that speech, he famously decried television as a vast wasteland. In fact, TV producer Sherwood Schwartz later admitted to naming the SS Minow from the TV show Gilligan's Island as a jab against Minow, the FCC chair. Minow, the FCC chair, nonetheless pushed through a mandate that all TV sets receive UHF signals, thus opening the possibility for more TV stations. That, as well as the burgeoning social movements in the 1960s, and a critical 1967 report by the Carnegie Commission on Educational Television, finally broke the resistance of the NAB to the establishment of public broadcasting in the U.S. The result was the passage of the Public Broadcasting Act, which came only 45 years after the establishment of a public broadcaster in Britain. But the independent financing potential of public broadcasting in the U.S. was muted when a proposal to fund public broadcasting using an excise tax from the sale of TV sets was not included in the final act. Public broadcasting without that independent funding base thus became the ugly stepsister to its commercial brethren, getting their programming only that programming that commercial broadcasters couldn't make any money off of. Some of that potential was ultimately realized with the establishment of public access broadcasting on cable television, which did accord more independent funding and thus greater autonomy. Cable TV, along with satellite television later, widened the number of ostensible TV channels available to a wider public. But concurrent with that trend, there occurred another trend from about 1980 on of the shrinking of ownership across the entire media landscape. As we've seen, there was media concentration before the 1980s, but for the most part, that was concentration that was restricted to a small number of players within a given media industry. In the 1980s, companies started to build conglomerates across media industries so that it wasn't just a TV producer or a film studio or a newspaper publisher. It was a TV producer and a film studio and a newspaper publisher and much more besides. The raison d'être was, as usually is, profit. More profit can be generated by producing content once and then redistributing it along all of one's channels. So then a race was underway to consolidate media across industries, aided by zealots in government subscribing to supposed free market principles, but instead aiding and abetting the formation of the greatest media monopolies heretofore seen. The greatest chronicler of this new consolidation trend was Ben Bagdikian, former editor at the Washington Post and dean emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. In 1983, Bagdikian published a book called The Media Monopoly, which noted that there were just 50 companies which commanded the lion's share of media in the United States, and that the trend was to consolidate further, perhaps to as few as 6 media companies. The book was republished in updated editions 7 times in the next 2 decades to chronicle the continuing changes in the American media landscape. By the time the 7th edition came out in 2004, Bagdikian wound up being wrong in one respect. It didn't get down to as few as 6 media companies. In that book, he listed just 5. Bagdikian and many others also chronicled the negative consequences of such concentration. Increased commercialism, less journalism, less independence from the bottom line, more conflicts of interest, fewer diverse perspectives, and even life or death situations, as was the case in the city of Minot, North Dakota, which in 2002 saw a chemical leak from a train derailment which caused hundreds to be hospitalized. And when local police tried to get on the radio to alert the public, they found that 6 of the 7 Minot radio stations were being broadcast from a single clear channel office in Minot, which was unstaffed at the time of the leak. The response to this trend of media concentration crystallized arguably the most dynamic, successful, and inspiring media reform effort in a generation, the Media Ownership Uprising of 2003. The trend toward greater media concentration was critically enabled at the federal government, spurred to greater heights or depths through the 1996 Telecommunications Act and the FCC of George W. Bush, headed for 4 years by market zealot Michael Powell, son of former Secretary of State Colin Powell. The Telecom Act required the FCC to review its media ownership rules every 4 years, and in 2002, the FCC, to little fanfare, announced that it would likely amend a number of critical media ownership rules in part of its effort to deregulate the media, which would have made the trend of consolidation seen thus far look tame by comparison. And with key pro-big media Republicans and key points in the government, the major media virtually mute so that they could cash in big, and a considerable history of media reformers' hopes dashed from one medium to the next, the fix looked to be in. It was in this fight where I first cut my teeth on media reform struggles. But what happened wasn't just me and didn't happen overnight. It was the efforts of scholars and activists well before I joined the fray, going back decades. But I arrived when the moment, this fight found a moment to crystallize. Small groups throughout the country, including here in Chicago, started to organize. 5 of us in Chicago met a week before the FCC announced its media ownership rule revisions. This coincided with the formation of the group here in Chicago I'm a part of, Chicago Media Action, and efforts like helping to organize an unofficial hearing at Northwestern University, sending a team to Richmond, Virginia to the only official public FCC hearing on the matter, getting on Chicago's KNTV and in community newspapers to discuss the issue, and using the internet, without which the effort to stop this may never have happened at all. After months of nonstop outreach and activism, the FCC, nevertheless, to little surprise, voted 3-2 on June 2, 2003 to its proposed rule changes. But the public outcry was palpable, breaking FCC public comment records by orders of magnitude, as the issue ranked as the 2nd most popular news issue of 2003, trailing only the launch of the war in Iraq. And the corporate media were caught flat-footed, facing losing votes in Congress, and on September 3, 2003, an emergency court order stayed that FCC decision, just one day before the rules were slated to go into effect. That court order remained in effect for 7 years, and it's no exaggeration to say that it prevented a bad media system from becoming far worse. The Tribune Company, which gambled its future on those media ownership rule changes, whined on its editorial pages over the outcome. But that stay indirectly resulted in a Tribune shareholder revolt, forcing a change of ownership, leading to local billionaire Sam Zell taking charge and later running the company into bankruptcy, a situation the company still finds itself mired in today. The whole episode, nevertheless, was inspiring and revealing. Activism works, even on something as seemingly abstruse as media policy, where seemingly few outside of those who stand to profit from such policies seem to understand or care about such policies. The key to victory has been, ironically enough, the very thing that makes the media unique on this issue. They're the only ones who command the ability to debate their own politics. As a result, those politics are immensely corrupt, so bringing wider awareness to them by any and every means at your disposal turns out to be an effective tactic. The lessons learned by media reform activists in 2003 came into play again in 2006 during what's called the net neutrality wars over the internet. That struggle came in the wake of a number of policy decisions involving the internet, including what some scholars deem to be a key 1990 invitation-only gathering of government and tech firms at Harvard University, which apparently resulted in the government privatizing part of its internet backbone. The Michael Powell-led FCC took another step in 2002 by reclassifying the internet in such a way that weakened common carriage provisions of internet content. And when a court challenge to undo that classification failed at the Supreme Court in 2005, corporate ISPs salivated at the chance to pass legislation in their favor to establish a two-tiered internet, as it was called. That legislation came in 2006, entitled the COPE Act, and not only would have changed the internet as we knew it, it also would have irreparably affected public access television through the establishment of a single national cable franchise, which would have bled funding. The bill sailed through the House, aided to no small extent by Illinois' own Bobby Rush, the bill's first Democratic co-sponsor. Nevertheless, awareness of what was going on started to widen, mostly using the internet, and this newfangled technology called blogs. Plus, protests gained more attention, including a national series of protests in May 2006, which began in Chicago, called the National Day of Outrage. The House passed the COPE Act, but when it got to the Senate, internet freedom advocates with the wind at their backs were able to egg some senators on to ask critical questions about the COPE Act, which led to a famous rambling response by the Senate's lead shepherd on telecom policy, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, in which he embarrassingly and famously called the internet a series of tubes. Stevens got the COPE Act out of committee in the Senate, yet the PR fiasco from his remarks made the legislation too volatile to bring up to a full Senate vote, and the COPE Act died through inaction in the end. It's key to remember that the same recipe for victory with the COPE Act and this internet fight as followed what happened in 2003 with the media ownership rule fight. Build public awareness to build public involvement when public awareness and involvement are lacking, and let the chips fall where they may. In 2006, then-Senator Barack Obama noted his support for network neutrality on his campaign trail for the White House. In 2009, President Obama appointed former telco executive Julius Genachowski chair of the FCC and tasked with approving a net neutrality bill. Last month, that actually happened. On December 21st, 2010, the FCC did implement a net neutrality bill, but one which has been roundly criticized as being too weak and full of loopholes. The struggle on this will continue to improve that bill, as it always does. So after all of this, what are some of the big picture points that can be raised? Let me mention three brief lessons. Lesson one, American media don't just fall from the sky. They're the result of a number of factors, and most critically, the policies that help to shape the media. While major media would like you to believe that the media spring from natural processes, there's nothing natural about them. They're often very bitterly fought. Lesson two, people can affect those policies. And I'm not referring to high-paid, well-connected lobbyists. Everyday normal people can affect those policies. Indeed, a number of defeats that we had seen in points of the media reform struggles in American history were often by narrow margins. And if things had gone slightly differently, those losses could have been wins. On the other hand, a number of reform wins that we can claim, especially in recent years, came when those efforts had no right to do so. but because people were willing to do the work in organizing, outreach, smart planning, and in a word, getting involved. The more people get involved in shaping those media, the better our chances for success. And lesson number three, we have to work to change institutions that affect media but are not media. We seem to be stuck between two obsolete institutional frameworks that have affected media and much else for centuries. A single government, the state, in the political sphere, and a single market spawning corporations in the economic sphere. Much of the struggle for a better media have been struggling against one, sometimes both, of these institutional spheres. Much of the struggle will mean struggling for fighting in that. And in order to ensure a better media, and much else besides, those institutions, I think, should be changed, at the very least, rethought. There's been a rich tradition of thinking on this front, and a great many new theoretical developments, much of which has been maligned as heretical, understandably by those with power. But I think that a better media requires better political and economic institutions. What those might look like, how the media would look and operate on that front, and how such institutions can be achieved fall outside the scope of this presentation. But we do ourselves no favor to ignore the question forever. Indeed, by tackling it, we may well be on our way to far greater successes tackling corporate media control and winning in media reform. Thank you very much. I look forward to your questions and comments.
Questions,
yeah,
for you?
Yeah. Okay. Laurel, go ahead, field
okay.
Questions, please.
Okay, I'm just amazed at the amount of information we just heard in a short time, and trying to process. And I have to make a comment that since I've known Mitchell, he has been, you know, so immersed in all these struggles. I remember last year when you were fighting those changes that made us all have to put those ugly boxes on top of our TV.
The digital television.
Yes, yep. Digital television. And since I don't see any hands yet, let me ask you, what the heck are those, what's that all about? What are those little boxes, and why do they complicate my life so much?
What Laurel's referring to is the conversion that took place over the last 5+ years, but was finalized on June 12, 2009, of digital television. The idea that previously television had been broadcast by analog waves through the airwaves on the electromagnetic spectrum. But it was discovered that broadcast, the signal quality as well as signal quantity could be improved by turning that to digital, basically changing that analog wave into a series of ones and zeros to be broadcast through the air. Problem is that for many people who don't have cable or satellite service, and that estimates of that were about maybe 20% of all Americans, their only option was to basically convert along with that. And the government provided efforts, including funding about a $2 billion program for vouchers to help to provide, pay for converter boxes. There are a few problems with that, not the least of which is that that program ended in the black. About half of the money that was allotted for that program wound up getting unspent. People didn't claim the boxes that the vouchers that they could have used to help to pay for those. So that leads me to think that actually a lot of people are still without television. Now, a lot of people may say, okay, big deal. TV's full of crap. Why should I care? Well, for a lot of people who don't have a whole lot in the way of media resources, a lot of TV was basically one of the few outlets that they could reliably have. The problem now with that is that we've all changed, and there's not really much in the way of institutional impetus to try to change back. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I think this is part of parcel of the overall movements for general equality, to make sure that the people who need media can get media. And it's not just with television, but with the entirety, especially regarding the digital divide, where people who, maybe 40% of Americans, can't afford internet access on a regular basis. And so that this is probably part of that struggle to help to ensure greater equality regarding media generally. And this digital television fight has been part and parcel of that.
Yeah, I see a lot of the organizations and activists and et cetera that I used to rely on getting information via their websites going on to Facebook. And it seems like they let their website sit, and everything that they need people to know or want to broadcast out there, they put on their Facebook page. And I'm wondering what you think about that medium, as both as far as to what extent, you know, there's a potential for them to start controlling content, and would they do so? and also whether it's any substitute for some of the other avenues that we used to use to talk to each other and get out the truth, because I feel like it's kind of a short attention span media.
So the question about Facebook, is Facebook hampering or a good thing or a bad thing regarding some of these other media trends? Facebook is barely 6 years old. It has grown with astonishing rapidity. It basically was a guy, you know, if you've seen the movie The Social Network, you know the story. Nerd at Harvard comes up with an idea for a website, and lo and behold, it actually becomes, you know, immensely popular, the most popular website on the entire web, in fact. I can see both good and bad coming from it. Good in the sense that now a lot of people use it as an avenue for social networking of ideas, so ideas or whatevers can travel with even greater speed than before, and I count that as a good thing. Bad thing for two reasons. One is, as the media and internet ecosystem is concerned, that's a lot of eggs to put in one basket.
Yeah.
And if Facebook goes down, or if something happens regarding Facebook, it encounters some kind of a super aggressive corporate takeover scheme. It may who knows what may happen. Plus, also the fact that it's a commercial entity. I mean, they're there to make money, admittedly. So that there's that pressure there that they have to try to fight and attend to. There have been attempts. They're still kind of like in the very early stages, to try to provide grassroots equivalents of Facebook. Some of these have gotten some attention. A lot of them are still very nascent, nowhere near the scale of Facebook, but that might be a beneficial hope. The hope is that, you know, Facebook remains enough of an open, and I think, remember also regarding social media, trends can change fast, both in the up and in the down, so that, you know, well, I mean, not only laugh at Facebook, MySpace.
Yeah.
I mean, MySpace is laying off half their staff, and there's talk that News Corporation, Fox, Rupert Murdoch, which paid $580 million to buy the website in 2005, may well sell it off because nobody goes there anymore. In fact, you can actually now access MySpace through Facebook. It's gotten that bad.
That was a presentation entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles, recorded at Chicago's Third Unitarian Church on January 16, 2011. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. To learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Aaron Sinek for audio assistance, and thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode from the Trenches.